The Reverend Dr. Horton, waving a white handkerchief, cried to the police, "Gentlemen, I beseech you to stop firing. We are non-combatants. If you want to arrest us, make any arrest you please. We are not prepared to defend ourselves." Some of the police, it is claimed, replied, "We don't want any prisoners. You have all got to die." Dr. Horton was shot and fell, mortally wounded. Dr. Dosti, who was an object of special animosity on account of his inflammatory addresses, was a marked victim, shot through the spine and with a sword thrust through his stomach. He died a few days later. There were about 150 persons in the hall, mostly Negroes. Seizing chairs, they beat back the police three times and barred the doors, but the police returned to the attack, firing their revolvers as they came. Some of the Negroes returned the fire, but most of them leaped from the windows in wild panic. In some cases, they were shot as they came down or as they scrambled over the fence at the bottom. The only member of the convention, however, that was killed was a certain John Henderson. Some 600 or 700 shots were fired. Negroes were pursued and in some cases were killed on the streets. One of them, 2 miles from the scene, was taken from his shop and wounded in the side, hip and back. The dead and wounded were piled upon drays and carried off. Some say that 48 were killed outright, 68 were severely wounded, and 98 slightly wounded in the hall and on the streets. Other reports say that 38 people were killed and 148 wounded, and of the 38, all but 4 were colored. As Sheridan said, it was no riot. It was an absolute massacre. Too late, General Baird and the federal soldiers arrived and proclaimed martial law. Mayor Monroe's threat to break up the convention succeeded completely, and but for the appearance of United States troops, the killing would undoubtedly have been much greater than it was. After this, many Union men left the state permanently, and the new rule of organized anarchy ensued. The New Orleans riot was a characteristic gesture of the time and place. Most of the elected white members of the convention kept in the background to see what trouble was brewing. Negroes assembled, most of them as spectators, to find out what was going to be done for their enfranchisement. It was these black spectators upon whom the brunt of murder and assassination fell. There was an unusual moral aftermath to this inexcusable slaughter, in that it helped turn the national election of 1866 overwhelmingly against Andrew Johnson. It was against this background of lawlessness and murder, this practical reopening of the Civil War, that Congressional Reconstruction began. Under the National Reconstruction Act in Louisiana, 127,639 registered, of whom 82,907 were blacks. When Negro suffrage seemed inevitable, some effort was made on the part of the planters to gain the Negroes' support. They began by cajoling the field hands. In a meeting in Rapids Parish, held by the planters, they said they would hold in high esteem the freedmen among us who ranged themselves on our side. Duncan F. Kinner, a prominent politician, urged the people to accept Negroes and to try and gain their vote for the South. General P.G.T. Beauregard, who began the fighting at Fort Sumter and wanted to raise the black flag after emancipation, said, "If the suffrage of the Negro is properly handled and directed, we shall defeat our adversaries with their own weapons. The Negro is Southern-born, with a little education and a property qualification. He can be made to take an interest in the affairs of the South and in his prosperity. He will fight with the whites." On March 18th, General Longstreet, a Confederate general, published 2 open letters advising submission to Congress. "It becomes us to insist that suffrage be extended in all the states and fully tested." Other prominent Confederates agreed. Longstreet's wife afterwards declared that this was the noblest act of her husband's life. But these overtures of a few planters were more than neutralized by the bulk of white Southern opinion, which was bitter beyond description. All Republicans were bitterly assailed. The shameless, heartless, vile, grasping, deceitful, creeping, crawling, wallowing, slimy, slippery, hideous, loathsome political pirates who, in the name of God and liberty, rob the South and put the Southern states under a black government. Everything was said that would disparage or discredit the officials. Nothing was said to explain or justify their acts or their conduct. On the 25th of April, 7 days after the election of officers under the new Constitution, the courier of the Tetchy said, 14 men having a covering of white skin over their flesh have voted for the mongrel Constitution in the parish of St. Martin. May they be pointed out with the finger of scorn by all honorable men. May they be despised and hated by every living creature. May their wives, if such creatures can have wives, remain barren, that their descendants may not rot in jail or die of exhaustion in houses of ill fame. The Banner, the leading paper in its congressional district, said on the 20th of June, as the Republican members of the legislature and state government were assembling in New Orleans, "These miserable devils are worse than the itch, smallpox, measles, overflow, drafts, and pestilence." On the other hand, Negroes kept hammering at their economic condition. A meeting was held in the First African Church in May 1867 to colonize colored laborers on colored homesteads. From this time until the new Constitutional Convention met, the Tribune pled for a high class of delegates to the convention. From the president down to the doorkeeper, and from the clerk and the chief reporter down to the printer, the choices should be made so as to convince the people of the state that the supremacy of a privileged class will be no longer fostered, and the time has come when the representatives of the colored race can find favor as well as white men. It is to be demonstrated that long services and unfaltering devotion to the cause of radicalism shall obtain the reward, irrespective of color or race, and to that effect, it is important to choose officers from among both populations. But there is something more. It is important to show that the oppressed race will not be overlooked, that from this time forward, the rights of the neglected race will be recognized to share in all departments of our state government. The convention will have many things to do to break the spell under which we were laboring. The choice of officers will, therefore, have a political bearing and cannot be dictated by fitness only. The convention will meet under very peculiar circumstances, circumstances of originality and grandeur. It will be the first constitutional assembly, the first official body ever convened in the United States without distinction of race or color. It will be the first mixed assemblage, clothed with a public character. As such, this convention has to take a position in immediate contradiction with the old assemblies of the white man's government. They will have to show that a new order will succeed the former order of things, and that the long-neglected race will at last effectually share in the government of the state. By agreement, the 98 delegates to the Louisiana Convention consisted of 49 Negroes and 49 whites. Among the Negroes were many free colored men of intelligence, property, and character, but when it was suggested that subordinate officers be equally divided between the races, PBS Pinchback, one of the colored leaders, objected and declared that was placing race above merit. The Negro members of the Constitutional Convention took a prominent and effective part. They were largely represented on committees, such as the Committee of 13 on Rules and Regulations, where they had 4 members. In several cases, they acted as chairmen of committees, as in the case of the Committee on the Militia and the Committee on the Bill of Rights. Their attitude, however, is best seen in the report of the committee to draft a constitution. The 5 white members of the committee and the 4 colored members differed in certain essential particulars and sent in respectively a majority and minority report. The chief points of difference were these. The white men wished to deprive all of the leaders of the Confederacy of the right to vote or hold office, while the colored men would allow them to vote, but restricted their right to hold office. The white men wished to prevent any law being passed regulating labor or fixing wages. The colored men wished no such restrictions, and also demanded that children bound out under the former black laws should be returned to their parents and relatives. The white men made provisions for the education of youth, but the colored men were more specific and demanded at least one free public school in every parish to be provided for by public taxation and with no distinction as to race and sex. They also asked for a university with 6 faculties and a state lottery for the support of education and charity. While the white men wanted 98 state representatives, the colored men wanted 102, which probably gave certain colored sections a larger representation. In the final constitution, a compromise provided that no law should be passed fixing the price of manual labor, that there should be 101 representatives, that Confederate leaders could neither vote nor hold office, and that the colored men's proposal for education, including no separation in schools and a university, should prevail. The colored men assented to this constitution, but 2 of them, Pinchback and Blandin, together with 2 white men, protested against the disfranchisement of former Confederates. As we are now and ever have been advocates of universal suffrage, it is interesting to note that the colored men who published the Daily Tribune were the official printers of the convention journal. The convention adopted the Constitution March 19, 1868. This constitution made the Negroes equal to the whites and provided equal rights and privileges. Public schools were thrown open to both races. All adult male citizens resident in Louisiana for 1 year could vote, except certain classes of Confederates. The labor laws passed by the Democratic legislature of 1865 were declared null and void. The planters reviled the Constitution and called it the work of the lowest and most corrupt body of men ever assembled in the South. It was the work of ignorant Negroes, cooperating with a gang of white adventurers, strangers to our interests and our sentiments. It was originated by carpetbaggers and was carried through by such arguments as are printed on green-backed paper. It was one of the long catalogues of schemes of corruption which make up the whole history of that iniquitous radical conclave. In the face of this, the laws of Louisiana, as codified on the basis of this Constitution and subsequent legislation, were finally adopted in 3 main codes, signed by the black lieutenant governor of the state, Oscar J. Dunn, and remained this day as the basic law of the state. The free Negroes had since the war increased in numbers, wealth, and intelligence. On the other hand, the mass of the freedmen were ignorant and inexperienced and much lower in status because of their harsh slavery than even the Negroes of South Carolina. They had, however, 2 ever-insistent demands: land to cultivate and public schools. They had almost impoverished themselves under Banks to keep their schools going, and while their demand for land never reached the definite expression that it did elsewhere, it was always the great motivating ideal. The colored people produced some notable leaders during Reconstruction. Oscar J. Dunn ran away from slavery and finally bought his freedom. He had laid the foundation for a good education before he became free. Dunn was the only one of the 7 colored men who sat in the state senate in 1868 who had been a slave. He was lieutenant governor, 1868 to 1870, and was a man of courage and firmness. He was admitted by the Democrats to be incorruptible. In the view of the Caucasian chiefs, the taint of honesty and of a scrupulous regard for the official proprieties is a serious drawback, an enervating reproach upon the lieutenant governor. His sudden death in November 1871 was a severe loss. Pinchback, son of a white man, and himself indistinguishable from white in general appearance, was born in Georgia, educated in Cincinnati, and had been a captain in the army. He was intelligent and capable, but a leader of different caliber from Dunn. He was a practical politician and played the politician's game. Yet there were limits beyond which he would not go. To all intents and purposes, he was an educated, well-to-do, congenial white man with but a few drops of Negro blood, which he did not stoop to deny, and so many of his fellow whites did. Pinchback succeeded Dunn as lieutenant governor, and when Warmoth was impeached in December 1872, Pinchback became, for a few days, governor of the state. C.C. Antoine, later, was also lieutenant governor. The legislature sent J.H. Menard, a colored man, as one of the representatives of the lower house and Congress, but he was refused his seat. Antoine Dubuclet was state treasurer during 1868 to 1879. He conducted his office for 18 years without mistake or criticism. Politicians tried to find something wrong with his records, and the Audigier Committee was appointed to examine the archives of the treasury. They secured three expert accountants to investigate the treasury for 6 months. The honesty and efficiency of the treasurer was confirmed. There were the following colored officials in Louisiana: Charles E. Nash, Congressman, 1874 to 1876, 44th Congress; P.B.S. Pinchback, Governor, 1872, 43 days; Lieutenant Governor, 1871 to 1872; Oscar J. Dunn, Lieutenant Governor, 1868 to 1871; C.C. Antoine, Lieutenant Governor, 1872 to 1876; P.G. Deslond, Secretary of State, 1872 to 1876; Antoine Dubuclet, State Treasurer, 1868 to 1869; W.G. Brown, Superintendent of Public Education, 1872 to 1876; Augustine G. Jones, once Chancery Clerk of Assumption Parish, was a direct descendant of the hero John Paul Jones of Revolutionary War fame, who was captain of the Bonhomme Richard. Several of his daughters are now teachers in the New Orleans public schools. In addition, there were, between 1863 and 1896, 32 colored state senators and 95 representatives. These colored leaders had a task of enormous difficulty, much more so than those of South Carolina or Mississippi. They differed in origin and education. Some looked white, some black, some born free and rich, the recipients of good education. Some were ex-slaves with no formal training. They were faced with an intricate social tangle among the whites. Economic and social differences were, in Louisiana, more complicated than in any other American state, and this makes the history of Reconstruction more difficult to follow. First of all, there were the planters, rich before the war, largely officers and leaders in the Confederate Army, and now returned, embittered and widely impoverished. Then there were the host of traders, capitalists, and adventurers who had come down during and just after the war to seek a new field for investment in the conquered country, who were, naturally, regarded more or less as harpies. The number was formidable, for already by the fall of 1866, Ficklin says between 5,000 and 10,000 Union soldiers had settled in the state. Among these were Warmoth and Kellogg. Add to these the scalawags, the large number of whites, both planters and others, who became Union men during and after the war. Another factor was the numerous poor whites in the northern part of the state, living close to the subsistence line on the thin soil of the Pine Hills back of the bottomlands, without schools, with but few churches, given to rude sports and crude methods of farming. Their ignorance and prejudice bred in them after the emancipation of the Negro a dread of sinking to the social level of the blacks. The dread, in turn, bred hatred, and it was from this class, instigated very probably by the class above them, that the Colfax and Conshohocken murders took their unfortunate rise. And still one other element, mischievous in the extreme, must be added to the social complex: men who pursued no occupations, but preyed on black and white alike, as gamblers and tenth-rate politicians, drinking and swaggering at the bar, always armed with knife and revolver, shooting Negroes now and then for excitement. This class, recruited largely from the descendants of the old overseer and Negro trader of antebellum days, had just enough education to enable them to dazzle the Negro by a political harangue. They became demagogic leaders of the Negroes, on the one hand, and murderers and fighters for the planters. It was this element that more than anything else kept up the turmoil in the state. According to Nordoff, the first duty of the Republican leaders in Louisiana was to hang them by the dozen, and it was because they were not crushed out, except so far as the respectable conservative could combat them, that Louisiana had to endure such a drawn-out purgatory before she was reconstructed. The number of Negroes in the legislature of Louisiana is not exactly known, chiefly on account of the great mixture of blood. In the first legislature, there were said to be 42 Negroes, about half of the House, and 7 Negro senators. The election showed the predominant influence of the carpetbaggers over the Negroes, who had good reason to be convinced of the bad faith of the planters. There was never a majority of Negroes in either house of the legislature during my 4 years of service as governor. The legislature, elected in 1868 at the same time I was elected governor, had but 6 colored men in the Senate out of its 36 members, and though the House of Representatives had more colored men in it than did the Senate, they never constituted more than 1/3 of the membership. So it was in the general election of 1870. Only 6 out of the 36 members of the Senate were colored men, and there were fewer Negroes in the House of Representatives than in the House elected in 1868. Whatever legislation may have been worthy of criticism during this administration was the work of white men, in which the Negro members played but a modest part. The real fight that developed in Louisiana was between the planters on the one hand and the newcomers, Northern and Southern, on the other, and these two factions fought to dominate both the poor whites and the Negroes, usually by characteristically different methods. The planters resorted to the old method of cajoling the poor whites, giving them some political and social recognition, and using them as thugs and murderers to carry out their ends. The carpetbaggers flattered Negroes, bribed those whom they could, and gave them some recognition, but always at some crucial point broke their promises because they knew the Negro had no choice. Especially in Louisiana, the question of social equality between whites and mulattoes was an insistent source of bitter feelings. Two factions soon developed among the Republicans. Warmoth tried to appease the planters and avoid too great dependence on the Negro, but the Tribune, leading the pure radicals, said in 1868, "The Republican Party in Louisiana is headed by men who, for the most part, are devoid of honesty and decency, and we think it right that the country should know it. The active portion of the party in Louisiana is composed largely of white adventurers who strive to be elected to office by black votes. Some of these intend, if elected, to give a share of office to colored men. We admit that, but they will choose only docile tools, not citizens who have manhood." When the Republicans came to select their candidate for governor, the pure radicals proposed a wealthy colored man, Major F.E. Dumas. Dumas received 43 votes, and Warmoth, 45. Dumas refused the position of lieutenant governor, and Dunn was nominated. 5 white men and 2 colored men constituted the ticket, the other colored man being Antoine Dubuclet for treasurer. This ticket was elected. The new legislature met June 29, 1868, and the temporary speaker was a Negro, R.H. Isbell. He and Dunn tried to enforce the test oath, as they were legally bound to do, to the great anger of the rebels, who asked if they were to be excluded by a nigger from the seats to which they were elected. The legislature spent some time discussing a civil rights bill. This bill went over until the next session and caused high feeling and long discussion. The conservatives protested against the colored people forcing themselves in where they were not wanted. Pinchback insisted only on equal accommodation. "I consider myself just as far above coming into company that does not want me as they are above my coming into an elevation with them. I do not believe that any sensible colored man upon this floor would wish to be in a private part of a public place without the consent of the owners of it. It is false. It is wholesale falsehood to say that we wish to force ourselves upon white people." The bill passed both houses, but the governor was almost afraid to sign it, and the newspapers tried to frighten Negroes. Will any Negro or gang of Negroes attempt to exercise the privilege it confers? Belligerently asked the commercial bulletin. If they do, it will be at their peril. He may be able to obtain a ticket of admission, but no New Orleans audience will ever permit him to take his seat except in the places allotted for colored persons. It continued, apparently this state of calm does not suit the radical leaders. Their continual control over the state must depend on the jealousy of the black toward the white people. They feel that the colored race have more confidence in the old citizens of Louisiana than in any newcomers. Hence the effort to revive a strife which would readily quiet itself without much stimulus. Warmoth, in his inaugural address, ventured to urge immediate measures for the repression of lawlessness and disorder now rife in many parts of the state. From many parishes we have almost daily accounts of violence and outrage, in many cases most brutal and revolting murders, without any effort on the part of the people to prevent or punish them. In a special address to the colored people, Warmoth said, "My friends, this is a great day for the colored men of Louisiana. It is full of good for you, if my hopes and expectations in your favor are well founded. If you are honest, industrious, and peaceable, you will have millions of friends who will stand by you and see that you are protected in all the political rights which they themselves enjoy. You do not wish to intrude yourselves socially upon those who do not want your society, any more than you want other people to obtrude themselves upon you without your consent. The contest from which we are emerging has not been for social equality, but for civil and political equality. This last you now have, and it will be my duty to see that you are protected in it. And if I am not mistaken in my opinion of your race, it will be cheerfully accorded to you very soon by everybody. And remember that the roads that lead to prosperity for every man, whether white or black, are those of virtue and education, of honesty and sobriety, of industry and obedience to law." Unfortunately, the state government, inaugurated in July, was almost immediately confronted by a presidential election in November, 1868. Skillfully and with calculation, the economic problems of Reconstruction were being changed by planters and capitalists to look like problems of politics and social recognition. Beneath this deliberate camouflage, the industrial plans of the Tribune were being slowly submerged until finally murder and mob law seized the state. The whole South was in a blaze of excitement in the 1868 election. Tremendous and frequent meetings were held in every city and parish in Louisiana. Every Confederate sympathizer was encouraged and had hopes of what would happen to the South as a result of the election. The Republican Party in Louisiana was paralyzed. Secret semi-military organizations were set up, and riots broke up Republican meetings. Club rooms were raided and destroyed. It was believed that if Seymour and Blair were elected, Reconstruction would be overthrown. A civil war of secret assassination and open intimidation and murder began and did not end until 1876, and not entirely then. Strong as the hatred of the reactionaries was toward Negroes, it was stronger toward carpetbaggers. The Democratic State Central Committee sent out a letter, "And we would earnestly declare to our fellow citizens our opinion that even the most implacable and ill-disposed of the Negro population, those who show the worst spirit toward the white people, are not half as much deserving our aversion and non-intercourse with them as the debased whites who encourage and aid them, and who become through their votes the office-holding oppressors of the people. Whatever resentment you have should be felt toward the latter and not against the colored men, but in no case should you permit this resentment to go further than to withdraw from them all countenance, association, and patronage, and thwart every effort they may make to maintain a business and social foothold among you. Secret democratic organizations were formed, and all well-armed. The Knights of the White Camellia, the Ku Klux Klan, and an Italian organization called the Innocents. They all paraded nightly. In the election, Seymour and Blair received 80,225 votes, while Grant and Colfax received 34,859. Out of 21,000 Republican voters in New Orleans, only 276 Republican votes were cast. There were, in 1870, 726,915 persons in the state. A map of the state showing where violence and intimidation occurred leaves less than a third of the state in peace. Because of the experiences in the presidential election of 1868, the legislature was asked to change the election and registration laws and approved the law of March 16, 1870, conferring great power upon the governor. The governor was authorized to appoint a chief election officer who should make a registration of voters in each parish and a board before which the governor should lay all the election returns. This returning board was composed of 3 state officers and 2 state senators, and it could throw out fraudulent votes or returns secured by violence. This device made government by the mob impossible, but it substituted a possible dictatorship in the hands of an unscrupulous governor. Governor Warmoth's attitude toward the finances of the state was characteristic and original. There was need of money, and he raised it. His statement of the needs was unexceptional. "I found the state and the city of New Orleans bankrupt. Interest on the state and city bonds had been in default for years. The assessed property taxable in the state had fallen in value from $470,164,963 in 1860 to $250,063,359.63 in 1870. Taxes for the years 1860, 1861, 1862, 1863, 1864, 1865, 1866, and 1867 were in arrears. The city and state were flooded with state and city shinplasters, which had been issued to meet current expenses. Among the first acts of the new legislature was one to postpone the collection of all back taxes, and later they were postponed indefinitely. The roads were mud trails. There was not a hard-surfaced road in the whole state. There was the one canal and very limited telegraphic facilities. The mails were usually carried on horseback. New Orleans had but 4 paved streets. The amount of the state and city debt was unknown, and state securities were selling from 22 cents to 25 cents on a dollar. There was no money in either state or city treasury. New Orleans was a dirty, impoverished, and hopeless city with a mixed, ignorant, corrupt, and bloodthirsty gang in control. It was flooded with lotteries, gambling dens, and licensed brothels. Many of the city officials, as well as the police force, were thugs and murderers. Violence was rampant, and hardly a day passed that someone was not shot out under the oaks in defense of his honor. There was a demand by businessmen for more railroads. The legislature granted charters and voted aid for construction. In the past, every railroad in the state had been built in this way. 10 years later, the Democratic legislature of 1878 granted $2 million in bonds to aid in the building of a road to Shreveport, and the bill was signed by Governor Nichols. A great deal of state indebtedness was represented by this attempt to promote railroad building, and in this attempt, both parties were responsible for making the appropriations. The bill aiding the New Orleans, Mobile, and Texas Railroad passed unanimously in a Senate composed of 21 Republicans and 9 Democrats, and in the House were 50 Republicans and 9 Democrats who voted for it, and only 3 members voted against it. in the bill incorporating the New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and Vicksburg line, where the state assumed a liability of $6 million, the introducer was a Democrat, and it passed unanimously in both houses. The same thing was approximately true in five other cases where the state assumed large financial responsibility. The money which Wormuth raised did not go wholly, or even perhaps mostly, for public objects. He allowed all elements to feed at the public trough. Public debt and taxes mounted. Wormuth, his friends, and many of his enemies began to get rich in the midst of the surrounding poverty. When he was approached about this, and bitter complaint made at the mounting costs of government, he had a suave and effective series of answers. First, he said that a great many of the members of the legislature were ignorant Negroes and easily influenced by lobbyists, and that the men of the community ought to assist him in restraining them. Then he turned around and reminded property holders and capitalists that many of the bills which the legislature was charged with passing corruptly were for the aggrandizement of individuals and corporations representing their very best people. Their bank presidents and the best people of New Orleans were, he said, crowding the lobbies of the legislature, continually whispering into these men's ears bribes. How was the state to be defended, he asked, against the interposition of these people who were potent in their influence in the community? It is apparent that Governor Wormuth understood the term best people to be synonymous with the term richest people. He instanced the case of the $5 million bond bill to take up the city notes, which he had vetoed, which had been passed in the House over his veto. The bill went to the Senate. I walked into the Senate chamber and saw nearly every prominent broker of the city engaged in lobbying that bill through the Senate, and it was only by exposing the fact that one of their emissaries had come into this very chamber and laid upon the desk of my secretary an order for $50,000 that I was able to defeat it. Mr. Conway, the mayor of your city, came here and offered me any consideration to induce me to sign this bill. He also said that another senator of New Orleans had offered him a bribe of $50,000 and a share of profits for his signature to the Nicholson Pavement Bill. It was not only the fact that unsuccessful jobbers had tried to bribe him, but that successful jobbers and prominent Southern men, without reasonable doubt, had bribed him and knew it, and their mouths were closely shut when it came to details and special instances of stealing. Without a doubt, many other colored leaders shared in this graft, but from the very nature of the case, it was not a large share. Many members of the legislature, white and black, were regularly paid small sums, but on the other hand, leaders like Dunn and Rondinet were incorruptible and lashed the thieves on all sides. Thomas G. Davidson of Livingston Parish, who had been a Democrat in the state since 1862, said that there was corruption in the legislature no one doubts, but it was not confined to the Republicans alone. It was a colored man, W. F. Brown, who, as State Superintendent of Education, called attention in his report of 1873 to the way in which school funds were being stolen. New Orleans, as a legacy from banks and the Freedmen's Bureau, was one of the few Southern states that had a system of public schools. In 1865, there were 141 schools for the freedmen and 19,000 pupils. A school law had been passed in 1869, providing a system of public education without distinction of race or color. This system was not being carried out. W. F. Brown reported, "Stolen in Carroll Parish in 1871, $30,000. In East Baton Rouge, $5,032. In St. Landry, $5,700. In St. Martin, $3,786.80. In Plaquemine, $5,855. Besides large amounts in St. Tammany, Concordia, Morehouse, and other parishes. The entire permanent school funds of many parishes disappeared during this period. Many colored voters tried to swing their vote so as to stop corruption, save the schools, and improve their economic condition, but if this was difficult in South Carolina and Mississippi, it was almost impossible in Louisiana, because there was so little choice between the parties aspiring to power. Under these circumstances, it was exceedingly difficult for colored voters to know what to do. There is no question but that if the Negroes had been offered a chance to make their leadership effective in alliance with some party of social uplift, they would have followed it in large and increasing numbers. They would have become an honest and teachable electorate and rapidly expelled most of their venal, careless, and dishonest fellows. But what could one choose between men like Warmoth, McEnery, and Carter? A carpetbagger, a planter, and a scalawag? A buccaneer, a slave driver, and a plain thief? The expenses of the Warmoth government increased to a total of $26,394,578 in 4 years and 5 months. The state debt was $10,099,074 in 1860 and $26,920,499 in 1865. Subtracting the Confederate debt, there was a total debt of $17,347,051 in 1868. This, in 1872, had increased to $29,619,473. Besides this, bonds voted but not yet issued would increase the real and contingent debt to $41,194,473. The tax rate in 1864 was 3.75 mils, in 1869, 5.25 mils, in 1871, 14.5 mils, and in 1872, 21.5 mils. This expense was based on property valuation of $435,487,265 in 1860, which, with emancipated slaves, sank to $200 million in 1865 and rose to $251,696,017 in 1870. George W. Carter, the typical Louisiana scalawag, was a discovery of Warmoth, who maneuvered him into the legislature. He came to New Orleans soon after Warmoth was inaugurated. He was a Virginian, but had lived in Texas. He was an apostatized teacher, an ex-Confederate colonel, who later turned loyal patriot and anti-Warmoth leader. Carter was a man of education and polish, a good speaker, but an absolutely unscrupulous grafter. He was made Speaker of the House of Representatives in 1871 and became head of a ring proposing to control legislation that offered a chance for blackmail. The history of Louisiana from 1870 to 1876 reads like a Chinese puzzle to those who forget the great forces below. Beneath the witch's cauldron of political chicanery, it is difficult to remember the great dumb mass of white and black labor, the overwhelming majority of the citizens of Louisiana, groping for light and seldom finding expression. Historians quite unanimously forget and ignore them and chronicle only the amazing game of politicians. Under the election laws of 1869, Warmoth secured control of Louisiana elections. The governor, through the returning board, which he appointed, could at his discretion throw out any votes anywhere in the state on any pretext. It was to no purpose, so far as results were concerned, that voters were intimidated, mobbed, and killed. Consequently, the election of 1870 was unusually quiet. Then trouble began to brew. The colored men who formed the bulk of Warmoth's following were not willing to be simply his dumb followers. Led by Lieutenant Governor Dunn, they began a revolt in the Republican Convention of August 1870. The convention elected Dunn chairman, passed over Warmoth, and especially opposed a constitutional amendment which would make the governor eligible for re-election. Warmoth took the stump, adroitly flattered the white planters, and eventually carried his amendment. When the new legislature met in January 1871, he faced a new dilemma. Several hundred colored men joined in a large meeting at the Louisiana Hotel, depressed against his despotism. All the best elements of the state were arrayed against him, one wing of his own party, and at least a part of the Negro population. In addition, economic conditions were crying for reform. The colored men nominated Pinchback for the term in the United States Senate, after the term of Harris expired March 4, 1871. At the same time, a brother-in-law of President Grant, Controller of Customs at New Orleans, also wanted to be senator, and the president wanted him. Warmoth allowed a white planter to be elected. The result was that the Republican convention split in August 1871, with Dunn at the head of one faction and Warmoth at the head of the other. While Warmoth was temporarily out of the state, Lieutenant Governor Dunn discharged the duties of governor, although Warmoth resented it. Some of the Democratic papers said that they preferred a nigger governor to a carpetbagger. A state convention was called, and Dunn wrote to the leading colored Republicans, "I write to you to ask of you your support and influence in behalf of the colored people. We have a great work before us, and in order to be successful, we need the aid and cooperation of every colored man in the state. An effort is being made to sell us out to the Democrats by the governor, and we must nip it in the bud. I ask you to use your influence to elect good, honest men that will look out for the interests of the colored man and not be duped by the money or the promises of Governor Warmoth. And above all, do not elect as a delegate any of his office holders who, being under obligations to him for position, will be compelled to support his policy." Warmoth retaliated by joining with the Democrats in depriving Lieutenant Governor Dunn of his rights to appoint committees in the Senate. Dunn wrote Horace Greeley in 1871 after Greeley's visit south and his strictures on carpetbaggers. "There are 90,000 voters in this state, 84,000 of whom are colored. In my judgment, a fair and untrammeled vote being cast, 19/20 of the Republican Party in the state, including a majority of the elective state officers and all of the federal officers, with a few exceptions, are opposed to the administration of the present state executive. We want for ourselves and for the people of all parties better laws on the statute books and better men to administer the same, and we are persuaded that neither of these wants will ever be met so long as the present executive exercises any material control over the politics of Louisiana. We are engaged in no strife of factions, but the people gravely and earnestly are fighting for their personal and political rights against the encroachments of impudent and unfaithful public servants. Would you be greatly surprised, Mr. Greeley, to be informed that in the judgment of the good people of this state, irrespective of party, the young man who now occupies the executive chair of Louisiana, whose crimes against his party and his people you charitably ignore, and whose championship you so boldly assume, is preeminently the prototype and prince of the tribe of carpetbaggers who seem to be your pet aversion." Just at this point, November 21st, 1871, Oscar Dunn died, and the Louisiana Negroes lost an unselfish, incorruptible leader. This was Warmoth's chance, and he secured Pinchback's support and at the same time avoided the contingency of having Carter, the scalawag, become governor by securing Pinchback's election as lieutenant governor. This aroused another factional fight in the Republican Party for office and patronage, with the planters ready to take advantage of every opportunity and the Negroes deprived of their leaders. Warmoth rode this storm until his following failed, when he adroitly leaped to the liberal Republican revolt of the North, headed by Horace Greeley. When Chamberlain of South Carolina joined the Northern reform wave, he backed his move by excellent reform efforts, despite his dangerous and ultimately fatal alliance with disloyal planters. Warmoth had no program of reform. On the other hand, scalawags, like Carter, joined the anti-Warmoth Republican faction and urged them to armed revolt. In came the United States troops, and down came a congressional investigating committee and scored Warmoth. The result was that in the campaign of 1872, Warmoth took 125 delegates, one-fifth of whom were colored, to the Cincinnati Convention. This was the largest delegation that any state sent. This again was a shrewd move because the liberal Republicans were attacking graft and theft, both North and South, when this arch-grafter ranged himself on their side. Pinchback, under the advice of Sumner, was disposed to follow Warmoth into the Liberal Republican Party, but he was alienated when he saw that Warmoth, instead of leading a real third-party movement, was about to surrender to the planters. A curious campaign ensued. The reactionary Democrats nominated John McInerney from one of the worst anti-Negro parishes of the state, where Negroes and white Republicans had been murdered by the dozens. No self-respecting colored man or liberal of any stamp could vote for him. On the other hand, there was a Reform Party led by Beauregard, which displayed at its convention a placard, "Justice to all races, creeds, and political opinions." J. Sella Martin, the colored labor leader from the North, addressed this convention, and also Warmoth, who was working to have this movement and the Democrats unite with the Liberal Republicans. The Liberal Republicans nominated Penn for governor and a colored man, Dumas, for Secretary of State, while the regular Republicans nominated Kellogg and a colored man, Antoine. Warmoth tried to get the reactionary Democrats and the Liberal Republicans to unite with McInerney and Penn as nominees, a colored man, Armistead, as Secretary of State, and Pinchback as Congressman at Large. Such a ticket Warmoth was sure would, with his power over the returning board, win, as he said, by 30,000 majority. But the reactionary planters refused the coalition, and Warmoth capped the climax by surrendering to them completely and backing McInerney. There was nothing for Pinchback to do but join the Grant Republicans. He said, "It is well known, as far as I am concerned, that I have no partiality for the governor of the state. I have not stood at his back as one of the supporters or admirers of that distinguished gentleman. I am not a lover or worshiper of his. If I thought we could secure a Republican government in Louisiana by supporting Mr. Greeley, I would support him. But after a careful observation, I tell you, fellow citizens, if you wish a Republican government and the success of the Republican Party, you can only secure that under the Grant and Wilson ticket. Everybody knows how bitter I am against the Custom House and its party. But I tell you, my friends, if it is necessary to secure the success of the Republican Party, I will swallow it." All parties took great pains to assure the colored people that they would sustain and protect them in all their civil and political rights. The Reform Party, headed by General P.G.T. Beauregard and other distinguished white men, with the written approval of several thousands of the best white citizens, declared, 1. That henceforth we dedicate ourselves to the unification of our people. 2. That by our people we mean all men of whatever race, color, or religion who are citizens of Louisiana who are willing to work for her prosperity. 3. That we shall advocate by speech, pen, and deed the equal and impartial exercise by every citizen of Louisiana of every civil and political right guaranteed by the Constitution and laws of the United States and by the laws of honor, brotherhood, and fair dealing. 4. That we shall maintain and advocate the right of every citizen of Louisiana and of every citizen of the United States to frequent at will all places of public resort and to travel at will on all vehicles or public conveyances upon terms of perfect equality with any and every other citizen. And we pledge ourselves, so far as our influence, counsel, and example may go, to make this right a live and practical right, and that there may be no misunderstanding of our views on this point. We shall further recommend that hereafter no distinction shall exist among citizens of Louisiana in any of our public schools or state institutions of education or in any other public institution supported by the state, city, or parish. We shall also recommend that the proprietors of all foundries, factories, and other industrial establishments in employing mechanics or workmen make no distinction between the two races. When the returns came in, Warmoth sought to count in McInerney, and immediately the opposition set up a rival returning board and counted in Kellogg. They also got a United States judge to back them. Again, there was practically civil war, with two returning boards and two governments until President Grant sent down United States soldiers and backed the Kellogg government. The Louisiana elections of 1868, 1872, 1874, and 1876 were of one cloth: intimidation, fraud, open violence, and murder, so that there was no real expression of public opinion. Three remedies were evident. First, a dictator working through a returning board. Secondly, supervision of elections and repression of mob violence by the federal government. Thirdly, arming of the black militia. Carpetbaggers were too corrupt and planters too selfish to be successful dictators. The nation recoiled at federal supervision, not only in the drastic form proposed by Sheraton, but even in the milder form of supervised elections. Finally, arms in the hands of the Negro aroused fear both North and South. Not that the Negroes could not and would not fight, for these same blacks, largely under their own officers, had beaten back Louisiana whites at Port Hudson and Milliken's Bend. But it was the silent verdict of all America that Negroes must not be allowed to fight for themselves. They were, therefore, dissuaded from every attempt at self-protection or aggression by their friends as well as their enemies. Congress hesitated and refused to take action despite the pleas of President Grant. Under the law, he had no alternative but to use federal troops to enforce the Reconstruction laws. The result was open war. Three times the soldiers restored to power Republican candidates who had been ousted from office by force and fraudulent elections. In retaliation, the planters murdered Negroes and Republicans in cold blood at Colfax, Cushada, and other places, and fought pitched battles in the streets of New Orleans. It was a humiliating and disgraceful situation. Kellogg attempted reforms and succeeded in reducing the tax rate from 21 to 14 mills. But many parishes refused to pay taxes, and while the New Orleans Board of Trade and leading businessmen approved Kellogg's policy, his reforms could not go far. In fact, just as in South Carolina, there was nothing that Louisiana wanted less at that time than reform through Negro voters and Republican officeholders. Evidently, the Negro voter and even the officeholder could not be held to blame for the anarchy and turmoil which are the history of Reconstruction in Louisiana. Practically, so-called Reconstruction in Louisiana was a continuation of the Civil War, with the Negro as pawn between the two forces of Northern and Southern capitalists. The Northerners were determined to use the state for their own interest, but willing to admit universal suffrage under property control, while planters, united in secret organizations with poor whites, were determined to reduce the labor vote by disfranchising the Negro. Between these two forces, the Negro was victim and peon. His intelligent and sacrificing leadership was beaten back, deceived and hamstrung, and finally discredited by charging it with plans to Africanize Louisiana. The shrewd and venal and dishonest Negro elements were characterized as typical and used as an excuse for cheating and lawlessness by elements in the white population just as dishonest and much more influential. Back of this smokescreen lay the real charge, which was the attempt to subject this state so rich in raw materials and so strategic for trade to a dictatorship of labor, rather than an oligarchy of capitalists. The Panic of 1873 and the Democratic House elected to Congress in 1874 settled the matter. The Louisiana Democratic State Convention frankly called itself "We, the White People of Louisiana," and a committee of Congress sent down to investigate revealed the new temper of the nation. One part of the committee was completely in favor of the planters, while the other part declared the White League an unscrupulous engine of fraud and murder. The crucial election of 1876 came, and with it came anarchy. As John Sherman and his fellows reported, organized clubs of masked, armed men, formed as recommended by the Central Democratic Committee, rode through the country at night, marking their course by the whipping, shooting, wounding, maiming, mutilation, and murder of women, children, and defenseless men. whose houses were forcibly entered while they slept, and as their inmates fled, the pistol, the rifle, the knife, and the rope were employed to do their horrid work. Crimes like these, testified to by scores of witnesses, were the means employed in Louisiana to elect a president of the United States. The result was two sets of returns for presidential electors and for state offices, two governors, and two legislatures. The whole nation waited on the outcome in Louisiana, which would settle the presidential contest. There followed an extraordinary period of negotiation, probably unparalleled in modern government. The white folk of Louisiana, with threat of civil war, entered into negotiations with the president and president-elect, and arranged a filibuster of 116 congressmen to prevent counting the electoral vote. The Hayes Party promised to work for the material prosperity of the South and allay sectional feeling. Nichols and the legislature gave every assurance. They solemnly agreed not to deprive the Negro of any political or civil rights enjoyed by any other class, and to educate white and black children with equal advantages. Finally, the filibuster was dropped, and the electoral count was finished March 2nd. Hayes became president. An extra legal commission went to Louisiana in April. By means of money furnished by the Louisiana Lottery Company and large business establishments, the Kellogg government was bribed to disband, and the Nichols legislature obtained a nominal quorum. On April 24th, the federal troops withdrew to their barracks, and Louisiana was free for a new period of unhampered exploitation of the working classes. In South Carolina, Mississippi, and Louisiana, the proportion of Negroes was so large, their leaders of sufficient power, and the federal control so effective, that for the years 1868 to 1874, the will of black labor was powerful, and so far as it was intelligently led and had definite goals, it took perceptible steps toward public education, confiscation of large incomes, betterment of labor conditions, universal suffrage, and in some cases, distribution of land to the peasant. Ignorant and vicious leadership, white and black, hindered and even stopped this progress, and gradually tended toward a duel between northern and southern capitalists to effect control of labor. This succeeded first in Louisiana, then in Mississippi, and finally in South Carolina. In each case, labor control passed into the hands of white Southerners, who combined with white labor to oust northern capitalists. O, twin of monarchy, that lives to rob and kill! What deviltry here that prostitutes at will, that keeps a robber gang in kingly rights enthroned, then turns their robberies to legal acts condoned. Is not the blood as pure of him who lives by toil as he who waxes fat on idleness and spoil? L. S. Oliver.